NASA's Artemis 1 mission to the moon has been delayed for a second time after being scheduled to take off from Florida last weekend. When the launch does happen, Artemis will be carrying a number of CubeSats, small satellites, including one developed at ASU that is known as the Lunar Polar Hydrogen Mapper. The mapper's mission is planned to last 60 days, with the goal of learning more about water ice on the moon's south pole. A successful effort could lead to humans returning to the moon in the relatively near future. Earlier, I spoke about the Lunar Polar Hydrogen Mapper with ASU's Craig Hardgrove, the mission's principal investigator.
We have sent missions to map the distribution of water ice at the moon before, and they've produced maps from higher altitudes. So the resolution of those maps is somewhat blurry, and we really don't understand how much water is on the moon and how much is at the south pole and the north pole of the moon and where it's concentrated. We know that it's at the poles, but we don't know if it's only within these sort of deep, dark, cold craters. They're called permanently shadowed regions that never see sunlight, or if it actually extends out into the ejecta and the plains that are sunlit, but it might just be shallowly buried. And our instrument will be able to discern whether or not there are enrichments not only within these deep, dark craters, but out into the illuminated sunlit regions, just shallowly buried beneath the surface, 10 or 20 centimeters below. And the reason we can do that is because we have one science instrument on this spacecraft. The whole mission is been designed to make this high resolution measurement of the south pole of the moon. And that means we have to get extremely close. The other spacecraft that have gone to the moon before orbited from at the closest about 35 kilometers over the south pole of the moon. And LunaMap, because it's singly focused on this one science goal, will get down to about 10 kilometers over the south pole of the moon. And that's what's really going to enable us to make these higher resolution maps of water ice at the south pole.
I would really like to have you describe for us the craft itself, what it looks like, and why this is such a good fit for the project.
The entire spacecraft is the size of a large sort of Costco cereal box or a large shoebox, pick your favorite item. But it contains everything that would normally be in a spacecraft that's the size of often a school bus. So these are, spacecraft that we send out into the solar system are often very large, many room size or larger. And so we've packed a lot of new technologies into this little cereal box, reaction wheels, star trackers, radios, a propulsion system. And we had to develop a new type of science instrument that would have the sensitivities that we needed in such a small form factor. The spacecraft conducts a science mission in the same way that any other instrument or any other mission would, in that it propels itself into orbit around the moon using that propulsion system and the navigation systems on board. And we have an operators at ASU and at some commercial companies that help us navigate the spacecraft into orbit and on its long cruise back to the moon after we deploy from Artemis 1. And then we get into an orbit around the moon and make science measurements with our neutron detector over the south pole. The way that it's unique is that it's one, very small, and two, there's not a lot of redundant systems. Some spacecraft are often very large because you'll have many sets of systems in case there's a failure, and we simply don't have enough room on our spacecraft to accommodate a lot of redundant systems. We do have some when we could have software redundancies, or there were small components like memory cards that could be redundant. But for the most part, we're what's called a single string spacecraft. So any failure of a major subsystem is a pretty significant issue for our spacecraft. And that's often not the case for many NASA missions.
So when it comes to that, over the course of these years of getting this craft ready, what is the testing process like? Because when you're talking about not having much room for error, how much does that affect how you test it to make sure that it is, in fact, ready?
We've come up with, I think, a unique solution to this. And a lot of the technologies that are in our spacecraft have been developed over the last 10, 15, 20 years as part of low Earth orbit and Earth orbiting CubeSat missions. So a lot of this technology has been tested already in Earth orbit. It hasn't necessarily gone out into deep space, and that's where we're looking at the environments that our spacecraft will experience and doing a set of tests that you are closer to what you would see on a traditional NASA mission. So we have a lot of confidence in the technology because most of this has flown before. The testing that we've done is typical. We have a thermal vacuum chamber here at ASU. We put the spacecraft and all the subsystems through the temperatures and vacuum environment that it'll see in orbit around the moon and on its cruise to the moon. We also baked it out. You know, it's at really high temperatures to make sure that all those components would survive. We also did a substantial vibration test campaign. So, you know, when we launch on SLS, we're going to be shaking around quite a bit when we're up on the top of the rocket. So we did a set of vibration tests that subject all the subsystems to that. And then we tested them after those tests, and everything has worked. So we're able to, you know, in some cases we identified issues and then we had to revibe or re-environmental test. And so when we did our final set of tests, everything was working great after that test. So the spacecraft that we delivered to NASA in the condition that we delivered it in is capable of achieving this science mission. And this mission, aside from all the unique elements of it, is somewhere less than 2% of the traditional cost of a NASA discovery mission. The fact that we were able to do these tests and develop the spacecraft and deliver it to NASA, I think, is a real achievement and shows that this is something that NASA should be looking at in the future. These spacecraft can fit on pretty much any deep space launch that's going out into the solar system. And I think that there will be a lot of high-risk, high-reward mission opportunities like this, where you can collect complementary data that the primary spacecraft just really, it would be too risky for it to go do. But it's a very exciting and compelling mission that can ride along.
To what extent can this particular project help you and other researchers dig in further to see what that could mean for the future of traveling to the moon, the future of colonization of the moon?
The thing that really excites me about understanding the distribution and abundance of water ice at the South Pole of the moon is that the Earth, you know, from what we can see, is really the only planet in the inner solar system that has a substantial amount of water. And the moon was formed in this large impact of a Mars-sized planetary body with the Earth. And we don't really think of airless planetary bodies like the moon as having much water ice. But the more we look, like we've sent a mission to Mercury and we looked at the poles of Mercury and we see a substantial amount of ice on a planet that's much closer to the sun in regions of permanent shadow at the poles of Mercury. And so we know that this is happening on the moon. We see it on Mercury. It's likely happening elsewhere in the inner solar system. And understanding how much ice there is and what the distribution is important for really understanding how much ice was around in the early solar system when the moon was forming around 3.84 billion years ago. So it's going to tell us something about the conditions in the inner solar system around that time, which is important geologically and as a planetary system, understanding the Earth and the moon together. But like you mentioned, there's this other element of it. We're sending rovers, and the whole entire Artemis program is geared at understanding how we can sustainably exist on the surface of the moon and eventually send humans to Mars. If we're successful with this mission and we can create maps, like I was saying, that are kind of less blurry, more on the scale of a landing ellipse that you might expect to see with a future rover mission or a human mission to the poles of the moon, we'll be able to help NASA and future international partners plan missions to the moon so they know where to land. And if we see an enrichment of ice that happens to be not in a very inaccessible crater, like these deep, dark pits at the South Pole of the moon, but might actually be just beneath the surface in an illuminated region, that would be much more accessible for both robots and human explorers. And so that would be a great place to go to target a landing site for a future mission.
That is Craig Hardgrove, Associate Professor in ASU School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Principal Investigator of the Lunar Polar Hydrogen Mapper Mission.